Kevin Falta, thank you very much. And please do a goddamn podcast, will you, sir?
Thank you,
please,
Joe.
People would love it. I think you could help a lot of people by answering a lot of questions like you did today. You were fantastic. I appreciate the hell out of you, man.
Will
thank
do.
You very,
thank
very
you,
much.
Welcome to the 5th year anniversary of the Talking Biotech Podcast. 5 complete years of podcast guests committed to a better planet and better people, solutions through genetic engineering, and of course, all technologies. It's one part of the tapestry of different opportunities we have to improve the situation for people on the planet and the planet itself. So thank you very much for listening. So 5 years ago this week, I sat with Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan, who has really ridden his meteoric rise in visibility, mostly because of a top-ranked podcast. I think the episode I was on had more downloads, like maybe 4 times the downloads as this podcast has had in 5 years, in one day. So far, we're up to 244 episodes, 5 years, and about 1.3 million downloads. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for that. You know, as a scientist who has had some challenges when stepping into the public forum, either from enemies of science and friends of science, strangely, it's awesome to know that something is sticking. And what's great is that every week that this goes up, I get notes from people about individual podcasts, questions for the guests, questions that can be resolved regarding the content. We have so many good reviews on iTunes, something like 200 and something reviews. One person gave 3 stars, everybody else 4s and 5s, so not bad. Pretty good. There's somebody out there who calls it a solid C, but you know, can't win them all, right? So I thank you very much for this, because it isn't just me, it's all of us, and it's the listeners that put the fuel in the tank to drive the continued work on this kind of podcast. It takes a lot of work. I'm the number 17 podcast in the life sciences, and I know that doesn't sound that impressive, but when you look at the thousands and thousands of them, many of them highly produced, where this is what they do. You know, every week it's to produce a podcast. And for me, on my priority list, it's somewhere like number 20. It has to be. You know, I'm a professor at a major university. My main job is research, working with my graduate students and postdocs, publishing our research. We've had the best years of publication we've had in a long time, writing grants to try to get limited amounts of federal money. And then I go home at night and I help my wife, who's a farmer, who we produce fruits and vegetables. And every night it's treating the trees or planting something else or grafting or whatever. So I have so many other priorities that grab my attention aside from the podcast, yet every week we make it happen. And it comes together every week because of outstanding guests and outstanding listeners. And so that, I thank you very much. I'm very grateful for you allowing me to have this. So today's guest, for the 5th year anniversary, I wanted to have something special. And it really goes back to the early 1980s when genetic engineering was just starting to happen. And I was a kid, you know, I was like 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, but I was watching this happen. And I had an obsession with recombinant DNA. I thought it was such a cool idea. And whereas most kids my age wanted to grow up someday and meet Ace Frehley, I wanted to meet Rob Frehley. Rob Frehley was on the scientific team that, in conjunction with others such as Dr. Mary Dale Chilton, Dr. Mark Van Montague, and Dr. Jeff Shell, all these other groups, they were working on genetically engineering plants. And we've heard previously on this podcast from Dr. Ray Shillitoe, you know, some of the discussion about what was happening at the time. But Dr. Frehley was there at the beginning, and we'll discuss what was happening at the time and how it was coming together. You know, what was it that he hoped to see in the future of genetic engineering of plants? He then spent many years with the Monsanto company working in corporate science and the changes that occurred over the years inside that company. And then later, what would happen is he would really shift his focus from the science and from the management to the communication side and how important that was in changing the way he discusses science. So it's an interview I think you'll really enjoy and one that really marks a clear spot 5 years into the archive of outstanding guests and intriguing scientific discussion. Going forward, I think you'll see me revisit a lot of the original guests, trying to get on folks from Arctic Apple, from going back to the Aqua Bounty Salmon, talking to some of the people who promised us innovations 5 years ago and see where they are. So continue to listen. Thank you very much for listening. I appreciate it so much. And here's the interview with Dr. Rob Fraley. Today's guest is Dr. Rob Fraley. He's a former chief technology officer of the Monsanto company and also the World Food Prize winner in 2013, along with Dr. Mark Van Montague and Dr. Mary Del Chilton. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Fraley.
Great to join you. Looking forward to this.
I am too. I've wanted to have you on for a long time. You're one of the major gets I've been hoping to find in the last few years.
I'm going to do my best so you don't regret that.
Yeah, I don't think we'll have a problem. I've actually been following you since the early 1980s when I was a college student and watching genetic transformation of crops. You know, your work and the work of what was happening at the time was of great interest. So this is kind of almost 25 years later, yeah. Maybe more than
it's
that.
30 now. That was back in the early 80s. So
yeah, we're 28 years later, yeah. Able to really sit down and talk about it. So cool. So let's talk about your background in science. Where did you study and what attracted you to the area of genetic engineering?
Well, I'll do a quick story for you. So, like a lot of folks, I had the experience of growing up on a small farm in Illinois, and grounded early on in the cycle of life with livestock, and also the challenges of crop production, and dealing with everything from southern leaf corn blight to fungal diseases, droughts, and too much or too little rain. And so, I think that grounding on the farm was important as I look back. I went to a local small country high school. I had a great science teacher who was my mentor and taught me everything from biology to chemistry to physics. And in a small school with 18 in the class, he convinced me that I should go to college and study research. And I was fortunate enough to get to the University of Illinois and get my bachelor's degree in biology. And I was fully prepared to get a job as a microbiologist or food safety. And I went home for the summer after I graduated. And I got a phone call from one of the professors named Sam Kaplan, who I took a class with, who had just gotten a grant to study membrane synthesis and photosynthetic bacteria. And I jumped at the chance, and I went on to get a PhD in microbiology and biochemistry. So that was kind of my formal training. And then looking to do a postdoc, and looked around, and I was becoming, more and more interested in biotech and gene transfer. And at the time, one of the hot areas was liposomes. These are, phospholipid vesicles. And, the idea was we could stick RNA or DNA inside of them and use that as a delivery vehicle. So I ended up at UCSF in San Francisco working for Professor Papa Hajopoulos. And that turned out to be so pivotal because, UCSF is where, biotech really started. Herb Boyer, Stan Cohen, did the first DNA transfer experiments in the mid-70s. I got out there in about 78, 79. Everything was a buzz with what biotech could do in human healthcare. And, you know, people were cloning genes and introducing them into animal cells and human cells. And, you know, I guess I became fascinated with, could we apply this technology to crops? And so that, you know, I think it all started with growing up on a farm and, you know, having a chance to see how this science was exploding and, you know, in many ways being in the right place at the right time.
No, that's really cool. It would have been fun to be in your shoes back then. I was even kind of a spectator as a kid. I think I was 10 years old when I took out a book on genetic engineering from the library where I lived in outside of Chicago. I'm from Illinois too. And it was very fascinating to me that you'd be able to move genetic material. And so here you are at ground zero where all this is happening at the time and place. And what exactly was happening in plants, like in agrobacterium or other areas, that really helped you start to formulate how you might approach the question of gene transfer in plants? Yeah. Outside of liposomes, you know, obviously that was already happening. But what were some other things that were happening in plants?
Well, so as you know, at that time, when I was at UCSF, people had been able to, you know, introduce genes into bacteria, into yeast, into animal cells. At that point in time, no one had been able to develop a technique for introducing genes into plant cells. And, you know, back then there were even rumors that, I can remember people saying plants didn't have DNA or the DNA was, you know, had such a high GC content or whatever, that it couldn't happen. And so, you know, it was a big challenge. And, you know, people were exploring lots of methods. I mentioned liposomes. I also spent time in Mario Capecchi's lab in Utah looking at microinjection. People were thinking about viruses. Agrobacterium was getting a lot of attention because of its natural gene transfer, but there were challenges with, you know, selectable markers, with regeneration, and a lot of obstacles that needed to be overtaken. And, you know, when I started looking after I finished my postdoc for where to go, I interviewed at a couple universities. I interviewed at a couple of startup companies, Genentech, Agricetus, a few of the others at the time. And then I had the encounter of running into Dr. Ernie Jaworski, who was happened to be out in Boston at the same time I was attending a Gordon conference. And we met in the Boston airport. And I think a combination of Ernie's vision, his pure charm and talent convinced me that Monsanto was the right place to be, that they had the knowledge of agriculture, the resources, and the will to make it happen. And I guess that turned out to be right.
Whatever happened to liposomes? I know that you've, you know, written things on this in the reasonable recent time, like in the last 20 years. Does that technology still have some utility?
Not really in plants, but there's a lot of people who use lipid-based DNA delivery now in animal cells. And some of the breakthroughs were positively charged lipids and understanding drugs that facilitate endocytosis and those kind of things. So, yeah, there's a number of lipid-based vectors that are used in animal cell transformation. But in plants, you know, once Agrobacterium really worked well and we could see that it applied not only to, you know, to the broadleaf plants, the dicots, but also the grasses and monocots, you know, it's really become the universal system for both efficiency and breadth of utility.
Well, let's dive into that particular watershed moment. You know, here you had this opportunity to demonstrate gene transfer using Agrobacterium. There was, or at least presumably, you know, it works all the time in nature. You have plant regeneration, you know, being able to start from cells in tissue culture and regenerate whole new plants. So these two different spheres are both operating independently and kind of starting to merge together. And multiple groups at the time, and this has got to be early 80s, late 70s, are starting to think of how do we put these things together. And it really almost seems like, to me, like this would be a perfect movie for Hollywood, because you've got a number of different players that all have the same goal that are taking different approaches to get there. And can you give me a little more of the backstory behind the history of that moment?
Yeah, so I joined Monsanto in 81. And, you know, frankly, one of the reasons that in the end I decided it was key to be there was, and as you pointed out, there were a lot of challenges and a lot of unknowns. And it really was going to take multiple talents and teams of people working together to overcome all the obstacles. So, you know, when I joined Monsanto, Steve Rogers was already there, and Steve was worked in Dan Nathan's lab, and he was an expert in gene cloning. Rob Horsch was just coming in from Riverside, and he worked and had the magic with tissue culture and regeneration. And, you know, I brought in a focus on agrobacterium and gene delivery in general. And, you know, when you think about it, back at the time, no one had ever introduced a gene into a plant. We didn't know which genes would work and how we would screen and select them. We didn't know whether the kinds of cells that we could get a gene into would be capable of regeneration. And then, you know, we didn't know in plants whether, DNA would pass through meiosis and all of those challenges. So there were, a lot of things that needed to be developed and worked on simultaneously. And, you know, drawing on a lot of the success from yeast and from animal cells, we knew we needed to get a selectable marker. So, we worked hard on antibiotic resistance and glyphosate resistance as markers. Rob Horsch developed, the tissue culture and regeneration systems. And, you know, it's kind of funny because I joined Monsanto, an industrial chemical company, and almost all of our early work was done in solanaceous plants like petunias and tobacco. So, that's the kind of work we were doing. And, the team worked together, and I think that was one of our real strengths. But also, as you pointed out, we had the benefit of colleagues and consultants. I spent time in Mary Dell Chilton's lab. Jeff Schell, Mark Van Montague were consultants, as were, folks like Gene Nestor and Rob Schilperut and others. And, it was kind of interesting looking back. There was a lot of people in a lot of different labs and groups that were focused on the challenge of developing a plant transformation system. At the same time, though, there was a lot of collaboration and interaction and, lots of long nights at Gordon conferences and Keystones meeting where we shared our science and progress. And I think, the way I would characterize it, everybody kind of naturally would like to be the first. But I think what we all realized was, whoever developed these systems was going to help make a big contribution to plant science. So, while there was competition, there was also, a lot of collegial sharing of data and information.
Well, that ultimately was reflected in the way in which the announcement of successful plant transformation was announced, right? I mean, it was a collective effort that was put into the spotlight during a certain meeting, maybe in 1983. Or could you give me the backstory?
Miami Winter Symposium. Rob Horsch presented our work. Mary Dell Chilton presented her group's work, and Jeff Schell presented his work on plant transformation. And it was, I think, it really reflected the fact that. We all worked hard, and in the end, the field, benefited by that breakthrough.
And you mentioned that you grew up in, rural area. I didn't know that before. I had noticed it on your Wikipedia page that you're from Wellington, which is basically, it's not even on most maps.
Well, that's why I always tell people I'm from Hoopston, because it had a few thousand people and 200. And as I said, my graduating class had 18 in it. So it was a small school.
Yeah. I think the population now is 212.
Oh, my goodness. I'd be surprised.
Yeah, but so you grew up in this rural setting, and you saw the challenges of agriculture, the things that were happening, maybe a lot of the promise that was going on with lots of development, and in, especially in corn and soybean space, advanced hybrids and better crops, and millions of different companies, well, dozens of different companies producing hybrid seed. And then you're going and you're starting to look at being able to transfer select genes. And so what was going through your mind in, say, 1983 towards what the technology would hold for the future of agriculture?
Well, again, I think that was a real benefit of, you know, being part of Monsanto, where there was an agricultural company with lots of experience in, you know, areas that are important to farmers for controlling weeds and insects. And, you know, these were important areas at the time. They remain important areas today. I mean, anybody anywhere who's grown a garden knows that weeds are a challenge. Insects are a challenge. And, you know, it's still estimated that around the world that, you know, maybe 25 or 30% of the world's crop production is still lost to, you know, competition with weeds and insects. So those were areas that we focused on. And, you know, clearly at the time, Monsanto was developing the Roundup product. It had just been launched in 1974. And, you know, the fact that it was very effective, that it controlled all the broadleaf and grass weeds, would mean that if we could develop tolerance to glyphosate, the active ingredient, that it would be a very effective weed control system. And, you know, back at that time in the mid-80s, weed control in crop, broadleaf crops like cotton and soybean was still a huge challenge. You know, I tell people often that one of my more memorable experiences on my dad's farm was, you know, as a kid being 8 or 9 years old, you know, we would do the ritual every spring about this time of year where, you know, we'd get together with my cousins and the neighbor boys, and we'd walk up and down these half mile bean fields, pulling the weeds out by hand that, you know, you just couldn't control with cultivation or other methods. So it didn't take much to convince me that, you know, if we could develop Roundup resistance in crops, that it would be, you know, very important for farmers. I probably didn't realize at the time how significant it would be or how broadly adopted it would be, but it was clearly a breakthrough. And I think similarly with insect control, the, you know, the challenge of coming up with new modes of actions and better and safer ways of controlling insects was a real high priority.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that's great to hear the backstory on that. So we're speaking with Dr. Rob Fraley. He's the former chief technology officer of the Monsanto Company and the World Food Prize winner of 2013. And on this, the fifth anniversary of the Talking Biotech podcast, we get to talk to one of the experts who was there at the very beginning. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Going into year six, we want the Talking Biotech podcast to be more about you, the listener. Send us your requests for guests. Send us the questions that you want answered. Voice your concerns. Join us as a guest host. You see, we have built a platform. It's independent from universities and companies, and we control where this science show goes. The goal of this podcast has always been to raise the understanding of technology as it works in food, farming, and medicine, so that all of us can together combat misinformation, the copious filth that plagues the internet. We are here to help the environment, the food insecure, those that can have a normal life after a medical breakthrough, and of course, the farmers that feed us. These are the values that make the show continue. So your job is an easy one. Share the podcast in social media. Tell a friend. Tell two friends if you have that many, science geek. Tell people you don't really like. It doesn't really matter. What matters is that we continue to share the stories of science, the stories of technology, and the applications that will make our short time as a film of life on the crust of the earth a little more special. So thank you for listening. Send your ideas to kevinfulta@gmail.com. Share the link in social media. And now, back to this week's podcast.
Now we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast. We're speaking with Dr. Rob Fraley. He was the former chief technology officer of the Monsanto company and someone who I watched really grow as an outstanding communicator of science and someone who has been at the forefront of not just the science, but also sharing the science and public dissemination really becoming a priority through mechanisms like Twitter and stuff. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's talk about, you know, your role as the chief technology officer for Monsanto. You were with them during a big transition of the company from a chemical company to a seed company. And a lot of people don't know about this. So what happened around that time? And what were things that did change? And what were other things that maybe should have changed and didn't?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of looking back, you know, I give a huge amount of credit to, you know, the leadership of the company. I mentioned Ernie Jaworski, other leaders. The CEO at the time was Richard Mahoney. Howard Schneiderman had joined us from California as a scientific leader. The company was looking, you know, when I joined Monsanto, it was an industrial chemical company, and it was looking at this new science of biotechnology. Just as a small aside, way back when, Monsanto was one of the early investors in Genentech through some of the funds. So they were interested in this science, and they were prepared to make a big commitment. And, you know, just to put it in perspective, you know, I joined Monsanto in 1981. And we worked to develop the transformation, the gene transfer, identify the weed and insect control traits but you know, those first products weren't launched until 1996 and 1997. So, you know, the company invested for over 15 years in this science to develop these products, and I give them a huge amount of credit for their foresight and for their stamina and for their risk taking. So, you know, as I said, we were an industrial chemical company. I remember at the time as I was taking more and more leadership and management roles, you know, I do a lot of management training programs. And, you know, the big thing was companies trying to change and transform themselves. And, you know, with the development of biotechnology, I literally watched and helped participate, you know, as a big industrial chemical company became a biotech company. And then through acquisitions, literally became a seed company, and with more acquisitions, became a digital company. And so, you know, for me, what was rewarding was to see how science and innovation and products can really drive that transformation. And you know, I think you know, the science part, the focus on product development, were real strengths of the company. I think, you know, just to flag the, you know, the thing that we probably should have done better or probably should have changed or viewed differently, which, you know, has influenced me ever since, has been what we needed to do to bring, you know, the rest of the industry, the rest of the food system, and consumers at large, you know, along with the technology progress. So that's something that should have changed even more looking back.
That's something that I think all of us in science realized, though, at some point, was, you know, the way that we failed to welcome and inspire the public with our innovation rather than just giving them innovation. And,
yeah, that's true. And you know, I think the thing that I get a little bit of comfort from is that, I guess not comfort, but I don't feel so isolated. Is, you know, if you look around today and you look at the, you know, here we are in the middle of a pandemic crisis, and, you know, there's concerns over whether, you know, people will take vaccines once they're developed. You know, the story of communicating, you know, the benefits of vaccination, needs more help. You know, the country is still very divided on, you know, the science behind climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, we haven't gotten a consensus in that area either, you know, from a public perspective. So, you know, whether it's whether we're talking about biotech and GMOs, whether we're talking about healthcare and vaccines, whether we're talking about climate change and actions to move forward, you know, it's clear to me that, you know, we need to do a lot more as, you know, as companies, as universities, as folks involved in any aspect of innovation to bring the public and the decision makers along with the science. And for me, that's recognition of something that I think is absolutely critical. I often say today that when I give talks that, you know, it's absolutely critical to have great science to produce great products that can drive, you know, benefit to consumers, but without an equal effort on, you know, communicating that science and both to policymakers and to the public, you know, that science may not be successful. I mean, we've seen a number of products fail or delayed or not adequately utilized because of public concerns.
That's a really great point. And I think, you know, because we can innovate all day, but we're not translating that to application as fast as we could. But one of the things that I've noticed just in the time that I've looked at Monsanto as a company in social media space and even just in a website or whatever, there really seemed to be a big switch. So maybe somewhere around 2012, 2013, where you were seeing more and more employees engaging. I think you were engaging more and, you know, with the public in that point. And what was it that changed internally? You know, was there some real come to Jesus moment that somebody said, maybe here's how we fix it?
Yeah, I think, you know, looking back, I'm sure there were lots of discussions across the company, but I remember you know, particular meeting of our leadership team where we just kind of, you know, came to grips with the idea that what was going on wasn't working. You know, you think about Monsanto, you think about most companies who drug companies, chemical companies who develop products, they were used to the model that you put your effort into creating science and good products. You work through, you know, the regulatory approval. You know, if I were the head of R&D for a drug company, it would be the FDA. If it were, a chemical, it might be a TSCA or EPA or one of the regulatory agencies. You know, it turns out to develop a crop biotech product that, you know, EPA, USDA, and FDA are all involved in the regulatory oversight. So once we got our regulatory approvals, we thought it was almost, that was it. And all we needed to do was sell. And, you know, that didn't turn out to be the case. And then I think there was some belief for a while that, you know, the food companies or someone else in the latter part of the food chain would be more involved. And I think we just in the end realized that we needed to do more as a company. And that's when we became much more involved in outreach, where we really started to use the social media tools. Clearly, where consumers get their information on science has changed remarkably. The last time I looked, I think people now get 75 or 80% of their, you know, science-based information on social media and the internet. So no one's reading papers or, listening to articles in the newspapers. And so I think we had to adopt both the message, the channels for that message, and take the risk of showing up in forums like debates and meeting with local organizations and having the kinds of discussions that really make a difference. And so I realized early on that it was hard for me to ask other people to do it if I wasn't doing it myself. So, You know, I started getting involved in social media, and you know, in the last 4 or 5 years of my career, I probably spent half my time giving talks and reaching out to connect with individuals and consumers to talk through the benefits, the challenges, and some of the issues with products.
Well, really, for me, your big breakout was probably the Intelligence Squared debate. And that was like, December of 2015, maybe, or 2014. And that was a real interesting turning point because, you know, here you were, you know, as a chief technology officer of a company that a lot of people don't like, getting out to speak about the benefits of a technology. And you, of course, teamed up with Allison Van Eenennaam is fantastic. But against two other people who come from a much more emotional and kind of wearing a halo side. And yet you guys really walked away with a very clear victory, not only in terms of, the preaching to the choir, but also by shifting a lot of folks in the middle. And so was that a strategy you talked about at the time, or was it just kind of, you know, you talking about the beautiful parts of the technology?
Well, first of all, I would give Allison a lot of credit. I think it shows the power and wisdom of choosing a good partner. And Dr. Van Eenennaam was very very effective, very passionate, and brought her own knowledge of both the challenges and opportunities of genetically engineering livestock. You know, I think one of the things that's important in that format is, you know, we had an hour plus in order to address questions and deliver the key details for people to really understand it. And very rarely do you get more than, you know, a minute or 5 minutes of someone's attention. So, you know, one of the challenges I see always is how do you deliver an effective message in a short period of time, particularly when you're on social media. So, you know, part of the challenge is to figure out the content and the delivery that really is effective in delivering that a message. And that means, you know, being more personal, being more emotional, and understanding what people both want and need to hear. And, you know, one of the things that I learned, and, you know, and I, you know, I'm a, I am a, my mentor was Dr. Norm Borlaug. And for years, he and I would give talks, at universities and conferences, and he would talk about the Green Revolution, and I would talk about the Gene Revolution, and I adopted a lot of his messages and learned a lot from him on some of the challenges. And I found myself starting almost every talk with the fact that world population is increasing, which is true, that the demand for food production is going to increase, and challenges with food production were going to become very very significant in the future if we didn't develop new technologies. But as I started talking to audiences in California or New York City, one of the things I realized was, I was talking to folks who really had never experienced hunger or lack of food or availability. And one of the things that, I think our company and our industry really failed to talk about was how all of these innovations not only help food security, but also help enhance the environment. You know, and if you just for just a minute, if you think about the Roundup Ready crops, you know, they're great. They help farmers control weeds, but they, for many years caused for dramatic reduction of tillage and erosion and water and soil moisture evaporation. They had a huge environmental benefit, and the insect protected crops enabled farmers to target just selective insects, keep the beneficials. The technology that was that's been developed through breeding and biotech that increased crop yields has a profound effect on reducing how many acres need to be planted. So the environmental story, I think we'd often overlooked or ignored. And in many cases, it's even more powerful to a lot of people than food security. And so I think learning that and recognizing how people identify with the environment, it creates a different starting point for a conversation.
Well, you mentioned the Roundup Ready technology, and you know, certainly you're familiar with what's happening in the area of Roundup and glyphosate. And do you have any particular feelings, or you know, I guess, what is your take on what's happening right now with respect to that chemical, and is it something farmers will continue to have access to?
I believe so. I mean, the science is squarely in favor of the technology. The EPA has just recently reviewed the whole data package for glyphosate and absolutely put it at its highest level of safety and concluded that it had was not a carcinogen, and so has every other major regulatory body in the world. It's unfortunate that the IARC organization and WHO came to a different conclusion, but it's not unexpected. I think of the 1,000 different compounds or activities that they've reviewed, they've determined that about 995 are carcinogens, and that includes about everything we eat or get exposed to. There's a long connection between IARC and the plaintiff's bar, and that it's something we you can look into and educate your listeners to. But you know, I think the science is strong. I think the product is very effective, very safe, and it's going to continue to be a key component of agriculture and food production around the world.
Well, when you look at the landscape of new technologies, whether they're genetic or computational or whatever, what gets you most excited about the next wave of farming?
Well, I think, we're going to see, on the biology side, I'd point out two things. So first of all, breeding crops, whether it's corn or soybeans or smallholder crops in Africa, has now completely changed with, having, the knowledge of every single gene in the seed. And, the mapping technologies, the testing technologies, the screening technologies, the costs have come down precipitously. There's projects going on to complete basically the gene mapping of every one of the small and large crop species. And what that does is give breeders, incredible insight. They can identify rare recombinants. They can create new combinations, which will greatly accelerate, yield gains from breeding. And molecular breeding is taking yields to a new level, and that's why we're seeing record yields in corn and soybean and other crops. Clearly the gene editing tools are becoming universally used. There's multiple different protein and nucleic acid based editing tools that basically allow virtually every biologist and scientist to modify selective nucleotides in the genome. And, it's universal. I was judging a science contest a couple of years ago in one of the St. Louis high schools, and, the high school seniors were doing gene editing. So it's going to have, and since importantly, gene editing has been declared by the USDA to be a natural mutagen, unlike like every other breeding cross, it doesn't have the expensive detailed regulatory costs, and that's appropriate given the fact that the technology has a very specific targeted change. So I think that will help make that technology available. There's still some roadblocks there because the European regulatory agencies have viewed it differently. They viewed gene editing more like GMO technology. And I'll come back and talk about that in just a second. And even in the U.S., while the USDA has declared that gene editing in crops is natural and doesn't need the additional regulatory oversight, you know, the FDA is treating gene-edited animals more like, you know, developing a new drug. And, you know, that's certainly one of the areas where, you know, Dr. Van Enenum is very passionate about, because there's so many opportunities to improve productivity in livestock and in disease resistance using gene editing. And, you know, it's kind of ironic as a scientist looking back at all this, you know, now that all of these different plant genomes have been sequenced, you know, we realize that nature has been moving genes between species from the beginning of time. And almost every week now, there's a new example of genes being moved from historically from insects or from fungal organisms into crops or from, you know, between different crop species. And so, you know, it turns out, you know, I always like to say that nature probably turns out to be a pretty good genetic engineer.
Yeah, there's a lot of genetic variation that we can blame on that. I can bore you silly with some of the things I'm working on, but it's right now a lot of the interest in engineering is really its precision and the way we can do this better than we ever could before. And you mentioned gene editing. You know, it does this kind of technology take what really was a consolidating field, you know, where you went from hundreds of seed companies down to essentially three. And now does gene editing really democratize that, where you start to see potentially more work released from small companies or academic labs?
Yeah, I think not only gene editing, but also, you know, the other great advance that's transforming, you know, farming and agriculture is the digitization of the farm, where, you know, we're collecting hundreds of different data layers from every acre. We have the ability to, you know, to visualize and monitor every plant in the field. You know, I basically say, I think everyone's familiar with the concept of personalized medicine, where, you know, you go into a doctor's office, you get your DNA sequence, that information lets you know maybe what particular type of mutation has occurred in your body or what type of metabolic enzymes may be more amenable to different types of pharmaceutical treatments. A farmer has now got that same capability. I mean, they're mapping their fields. Every part of the field is a little different. Changing the fertilization, changing the planting rate, changing the soil amendments, being able to monitor that crop daily with satellite imagery and follow literally every plant in the field, you know, they're transformational. And to your point on the accessibility, you know, we're seeing the cost of gene editing and sequencing, you know, make the biology tools applicable across the board. And, you know, we're seeing startup companies and universities and small companies, you know, creating innovations. Same thing's happening on the digital side. I mean, you know, a wave of digital startups, you know, smaller farmers in Africa or India who may not have a big green or red tractor with a computer on it, all have cell phones and have access to weather information, market information, advice and recommendations, and can start to use these tools as well. So I think we're seeing not only a huge democratization of the technology and tools, but we're seeing dramatically increased competition. You know, I think as I look back over the last several years, you know, there have now been thousands of startup companies in the food and ag and digital ag space. And that's wonderful. It's, you know, a lot of people think because of the crop chemical industry or some of the seed industry has consolidated. I think there's probably more competition, you know, across the spectrum and across the globe than ever before, because there are so many new innovations. You know, I, you know, kind of aging myself, you know, I still remember when Amazon was an electronic bookstore. And now they're putting up rocket ships and building driverless cars. So the power of technology is it's transformational, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
I meant to ask you before, did the kid in the science fair know who you were and what you did?
You know, I'm not sure because her project was not in plants, but we had a great conversation. And, you know, when you walk away from that, I guess I have two feelings. First of all, I'm super confident in the future of science and the incredible innovations are possible. And my second feeling is I'm sure glad I retired because I don't think I would be able to handle the competition that's coming.
Oh, no kidding. I feel so obsolete. And, you know, I almost sometimes I feel like I should go into classrooms and teach them wrong. because here are the people who are here. I am teaching PhD students how to write really good grants. It's like, you know, back off, you know. Oh, man, it's funny. But back to the idea of agriculture, you know, what's coming next and our innovation, ability to innovate. At least in the U.S., do you think that ag policy can ever go as fast as our innovation?
Well, I think innovation always leads the way. The U.S. system is think it's a bit of a paradox. So, you know, I would tell you that in many ways, you know, and I'm speaking just on the crop side for now, you know, the fact that, you know, the coordinated framework, which was the original decision to have crop biotechnology regulated by existing FDA, EPA, and USDA regulators, was a good decision. It covered the food safety, the feed safety, and the environmental safety without creating a new wave of bureaucracy. And in general, it has worked well. And in many ways, it's still the gold standard for regulation around the world. Now, there are cases where things haven't worked out that way. I mentioned one of them. Gene-edited crops have one regulatory approach. Gene-edited animals have another. That will certainly slow down the advance in animal agriculture. There are countries out there that have really placed a clear priority on agriculture. Brazil, most notably, has worked very hard to transform their regulatory process. And in many cases, their reviews and approvals occur faster than the U.S., which is at a disadvantage. But I still think that the U.S. system has a lot of strength and in many ways remains the gold standard. And, you know, the agencies, to their credit, are constantly trying to update regulation. I think they're still influenced politically and by public opinion. And that's why I think the real challenge still is we need to bring the public along with us on these complex science issues. And that's a real challenge because, as I said, people get their information today through social media. So being effective in that regard is key to science communication. You know, there's a lot of different theories and a lot of different sources out there. And even as we, you know, today are experiencing the COVID-19 epidemic, there's a lot of challenges on getting, the scientific information. I guess I believe optimistically that as we get to the end of this pandemic and, you know, we have treatments and vaccines, you know, I think it will reflect on the fact that that science can bring huge benefit. And, you know, whether it's healthcare and human safety, whether it's food security, you know, I hope there's an opportunity for science to reclaim a lot of the public support that's needed. And it's key because we do have, you know, many challenges ahead of us as our planet grows and becomes warmer. And, you know, I, as an optimist, as a scientist, I believe we can do better, but I think our current system is pretty good. And we need to put our focus on that element of science education to the public and to policymakers, so that we're making the right decisions for the right reasons.
No, really good. And over the, you've had an extremely long career with tremendous contributions, you know, World Food Prize, all these other good things that have come from that. But what are you doing now and what's next?
Well, I have, I've enjoyed about a full year of retirement, and I've been blessed with two grandchildren during that period. So, you know, grandchildren and traveling with my wife, Laura, on a lot of the areas that, you know, we were probably too busy when I was working hard and she was working and we were raising a family. You know, travel is one of our key priorities. And, you know, we split time between our home in St. Louis and in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. So those are our two great locations. You know, I'm still keeping very active on social media and communication. If your listeners want to follow me, you know, on Twitter, my handle is @RobFraley, RobFraley. And, you know, you can reach me the same way on LinkedIn. And I'm still writing. I've written a couple of articles on the coronavirus and the impact of coronavirus on agriculture recently. I'm working with a few startups as an advisor, but also we have an organization in St. Louis called BioSTL, which is a startup organization. The Danforth Center, a number of other organizations are supporting that. And, you know, I'd like to see more ag and food related startups. So that's key. My alma mater, as I said, is the University of Illinois, and I'm working with them on some science communication projects, because I do passionately believe that, you know, communicating science to the public is so critical. And, you know, one of the organizations that I've spent a lot of time with that's headquartered here in St. Louis is the U.S. Ranchers and Farmers Alliance. And, you know, it's an organization that's been around for just a few years. But what's nice about it is it has farm group constituency, food company constituency, environmental groups, all working together to take a pro ag and food innovation message to the consumer, which is clearly, I believe, what's needed. So, you know, my passion is really focused on communicating the importance of innovations in the ag and food chain. And, you know, I believe that, you know, these innovations are just as important as innovations in medicine and healthcare, because the challenges, as we think about whether it's the next pandemic, whether it's a food crisis as a result of disease, or whether it's the long-term implications of climate change, you know, the solution is going to have to be new ideas, new innovations, new ways of doing things. And I think it's probably more important than ever that we see funding for these ideas, and that these innovations can get the support they needed to make a difference.
Well, it's a really great point to go out on. And certainly, I would recommend to anybody, please follow Dr. Fraley. And maybe one last question that if I can ask this one is, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, what advice would the 2020 Rob Fraley give to the 1981 Rob Fraley?
Oh, man, I think about that late at night. I don't know if we can talk about those things. I think I was successful because you know, I recognized that, it you know, early on, that it takes a team of people if you're going to have if you're going to make a big impact. And that brought me into Monsanto in the first place. And, you know, I've always been a big advocate of team-based approaches. And, you know, today, with so many bright people with so much complexity, it's more important than ever. You know, I think as I looking back, I wish I was probably maybe just a little bit more patient, a little bit kinder and gentler. That would certainly be one thing that I would tell myself. You know, a lot of the things that I learned early on, I mentioned my relationship with Dr. Borlaug, and you know, we often would spend time late at night, and he would talk about some of the challenges. I mean, the Green Revolution took a lot of hard work. It took a lot of energy. It took a lot of persistence on Norm's part because, there were politicians and regulators in India and Pakistan who, you know, didn't want to see, an American bringing, Mexican wheats into those countries be successful. And there were a lot of roadblocks. And, you know, even today, there are folks who would look back at the Green Revolution and fault what Norm did and accomplished. And, you know, he always said that, you know, no matter what you do, there's going to be pushback. And I think, you know, if I were a little bit smarter back in 81, it would have been nice to realize that and to do more to build, more coalition, more support, and to really recognize, you know, early on that you can only go as far and fast as the public and consumers will allow you. And that would certainly be the big lesson.
Well, I really appreciate your time on this today. It's funny because out of that whole cohort of folks back at Monsanto at that time, I think I met everybody. You know, I work very closely with Harry Klee, you know, who's here, and I've known Fred Perlack for a while and Rob Horsch for a while. And when you were coming to speak at the University of Florida, I was a little bit petrified because I kind of didn't know what to expect. And I'll tell you, you were so unbelievably kind with your time, and to spend as much time as you did with students and with me and with all the other folks involved, gave a great talk. It was a real testament to, that kindness and softness is very much alive and, you know, really, really helps your message. But thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you spending the time with me.
Well, Kevin, this was great. It's good to be part of the 5-year anniversary, and I appreciate the kind words, but I'll tell you, you've done so much yourself in terms of leading the charge on communication that it makes those words extra special. So keep up the podcast, keep up all the good work, and thank you for the time and the opportunity to look both backwards and forwards.
And as always, thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Come back next week as we start year 6 in the series. Please share with others. Think about us on the Patreons. You know the drill. More reviews mean more exposure to science, and we're in the top 17 of all life science podcasts. So that really means a lot that so many of you listen on such a regular basis. Thank you, thank you, thank you for that. 5 years ago, I would have never predicted it would still be around today. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast, and we'll talk to you again next week.
The Talking Biotech Podcast presents the personal views of Dr. Kevin Folta and its guests. These are not the views of the University of Florida, its faculty, staff, or students. Comment on today's episode on the Talking Biotech Facebook page. Send comments and suggestions to kevinfolta@gmail.com. And remember, tell a friend, write a review, or float us a little love over on the Patreons. Your support will directly translate into this podcast and broadening science education efforts everywhere.